From the Passover Haggadah to the Mishnah and Back, an Introduction to Rabbinic Literature with Rabbi Reuven Cohn, Part 4. This recording is copyright by Reuven Cohn and released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, including printed material to follow along with the class, go to www.reuvencohn.com. That's www.reuvencohn.com.
So we have just spent some time on Mishnah 4. We're going to return to Mishnah 4. If we had to give a title for Mishnah 4, what would it be?
The four questions.
The four questions.
Okay. What about when you were through with the four questions? We didn't look at that part yet. But Mishnah 4 has more than the four questions.
It's got the body of the Maggid.
The body of the Maggid. It tells you some stuff when after the four questions it says, and according to the understanding of the Son, the Father teaches him. So while we certainly could call the Mishnah 4 the four questions, we could also give it a broader title. It's the telling of the story. The telling of the story, the Maggid. Okay, now we need to look back at Mishnah 3, and we have the expectation for Mishnah 3. It's going to correspond to Urchatz Karpas Yachatz. Okay, so let's see how closely it corresponds. Why don't we start here and go around the other way?
Mishnah 3?
Yeah.
They brought before him. He dips the lettuce until he comes to the side dish of the bread.
Oy. So the word bread, in the Hebrew, it's pat. It doesn't mean Thomas's English muffins. It's a generic term. It can also mean matzah. And the side dish of the bread is parperet hapat, kind of flowing sound. So what is this? Mishnah 2 was the Kiddush. And this is, what is it? He dips.
It's the meal.
No.
No, it's a symbolic.
Yeah. But it's
food.
Not exactly the way we would expect.
No.
It names a vegetable to be dipped.
Right.
And chazeret. Okay. So chazeret is one of the maror possibilities. I think around chapter 2 they tell you. So the medieval commentators of the Mishnah and Gemara struggled with this. They weren't dipping maror at this point.
No.
What were they dipping?
Lettuce.
Karpas.
Of course, you notice some people did this for karpas, some people did that for karpas. And this seems to be saying, what do you use for karpas? Use your maror vegetable. So the medieval commentators say, you know what's going on here? This is looking at things through the eyes of a poor person. A poor person goes to market and he just buys one kind of vegetable. No, it's cheaper. You know, So if he's only going to buy one kind of vegetable, which is he going to buy for the Seder?
The one he can use for more than one?
Yes, he's going to buy the maror. And then this Mishnah is telling you, when you do your preliminary dipping, it can be with the maror vegetable. Fine. Okay. And then what does that next line, you dip the lettuce until he comes to the side dish of the bread? So the lettuce is really just that, it's just kind of like a side dish thing.
Right.
And this is a very tough phrase that people struggle to figure out what it originally meant, the original intent. But it might have meant you dip and you keep dipping until you come to
the meal.
So if that is what it originally meant, it would be, in the old days, you didn't have to starve while you were doing all the talking.
Right.
Because you dipped and you kept dipping. But another possible way to read this is, you dip now and that's it until the meal.
Hi.
Huh? Until the meal. Okay. Now, what comes next? Next line in this Mishnah.
They brought before him matzah and lettuce and charoset and two cooked dishes.
Okay, let's skip that line of even though for now. Let's put that aside for a moment. So now we're told you bring out matzah, the lettuce, the charoset, and the two cooked dishes. So what would this be? Don't you have a ceremonial plate mm-hmm. on the table? Mm-hmm. What, do you have a name for that ceremonial plate?
The Seder plate.
The Seder plate. So, anyone have any other name? So, when I was a kid, the name for it was the Kaira. The Kaira. Now, I couldn't quite figure out what it was. I probably thought it had something to do with Cairo, Egypt. But, of course, Cairo, Egypt was founded in the Middle Ages, so that wouldn't work. Turns out that the Kaira is a Yiddish pronunciation of the Hebrew word ka'ara, which just means a plate. So no wonder in America it universally became
the
Seder plate. You go to Kolbo or Israel Bookshop.
Don't ask for a Kaira.
Okay. Now, what's on the Kaira? Oops, it slipped out. Huh?
An egg.
Yeah.
Which is cooked.
Yeah. And there's a second.
And this. And the bone.
The bone.
A gorgle.
Okay. What did you just say?
A gorgle.
Gorgle. So I knew from.
What's a gorgle?
A gorgle is a halzel.
Our Yiddish is very different.
Yeah. My mother-in-law, who was from Warsaw, she called it a gorgle.
So there.
Yes. But we didn't use a gorgle or a halzel. We used a fliggle. And it was roasted to all eternity. I had no idea that it was a fliggle by the time they were through with it. But I knew from school a shank bone. I had no idea what a shank bone was. Okay. Although when I was in the butchery, they had these huge bones right as you walked out, right. And someone told me, that's a shank bone.
Okay. And that's the only thing you could get for free in the butchery.
And now I'll say in Yiddish, and it's metafula hant. It was generous. It was huge shank bones. It would take up your whole Kaira. Okay. So this is very interesting. The Seder plate comes out now, and it has on it, why should the Seder plate be out now? Because what's coming up in Mishnah 4?
The questions.
Yeah, so you need the Seder plate there as the prop. So this is a nice Mishnah so far. Not as exciting as our other Mishnahs. Nice. And then there's a little aside about whether or not Haroset is
a mitzvah.
A mitzvah. It says, bring out the Seder plate. It should have Haroset on it. But Haroset isn't a mitzvah. So what is it?
Who cares?
Okay. Well, this is another example of ritualization. If it's a mitzvah, you have to do it. What's the symbolism of the charoset?
The mortar.
The mortar. The symbolism is there when it becomes a mitzvah. when it, if it isn't a mitzvah, it's just a chutney, a nice spring chutney. And what the Mishnah says, you know, it's a nice springtime chutney. Everyone has it on the table. And one guy says, it's not just they have it on the table because it's a nice chutney. What's he say?
It's a lot like mortar.
It's a mitzvah. It has religious meaning. And ultimately, what has happened? According to the first opinion, you don't have to do it. It's not a mitzvah. Has anyone here tried to put a Seder plate on the table without charoset on it? What would happen?
You would be lynched.
The children would rebel.
Yes. Okay. Now.
Right.
Yes. Now. Who says it's a mitzvah?
Rabbi Eliezer.
Ben Tzadok. If the Rabbi Eliezer, Ben Rabbi Tzadok. Who says it's not a mitzvah?
Don't know.
We don't know. Okay. The editor of the Mishnah preserved multiple opinions. This is one of the most powerful features of the Mishnah. And Shia Cohen wrote an article in the 80s, which has become quite famous, in which he wonders aloud, how come rabbinic Judaism survived and thrived? And his answer is because the Mishnah honored multiple points of view. That Second Temple times were characterized by sects, S-E-C-T-S. Okay? And the rabbis managed to create what ultimately became a mainstream that didn't break down into sects because multiple opinions were honored. Now, what the editor of the Mishnah did is he includes multiple opinions, but he lets you know which one he considers preferred. Mm-hmm. How does he do that?
By attributing it.
Signed. That is what we as moderns would think.
No,
it's the opposite. Which is the preferred opinion?
The one that isn't
anonymous. So in this system, what is the price of winning the argument?
Anonymity.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about it, do we have anything like that in our society?
Dissenting opinions.
No, but they're named, and we know who the judges are. So that's not quite the same.
Amongst the very Orthodox, everybody has their rev that they follow. And they may have different interpretations and different meanings. So in a certain sense, you know, like in Israel, there was certainly a lot of different little sects, you might say. I know that's not a popular thing to say that, but. You know?
Okay.
So we have a similar thing, and yet.
Okay. But I'm asking a specific question. Do we have anything like anonymity versus named?
Versus named? Sure, all the women who wrote all those years.
Anonymity.
Well, what about folk songs? That is one. That's the only one I can think of. A folk song, if someone tells you this land is your land, that was written by Woody Guthrie. That's like, it almost interferes, you know, mm-hmm. Because the price of becoming a truly beloved folk song is loss of. Yeah, unknown, loss of authorship. Okay, so that's just a feature of Mishnah. If that feature where the opinion privileged by the editor is anonymous, which opinion does the editor privilege with respect to Haroset?
That it's not a mitzvah.
That it's voluntary. And that certainly has not survived the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That has... Now, that has become ritualized in the same way that we saw earlier, karpas has become ritualized. It's no longer just a salad, it's a ritual. Okay, now let's see the end of this Mishnah. We're about to turn to Mishnah 2 and start the Magid and pour the second cup of wine. So what else does this Mishnah have? What is on the table already? We've done the dip. And what's on the table? What have we put on the table?
Seder plate.
The Seder plate. And one more thing the Mishnah has to say.
Well, what are the two cook dishes?
Oh, so that's what you said. The two cook dishes are the egg.
Oh,
and
the shank bone.
The shank bone. Oh. And what's the Hebrew for two cooked dishes?
Shnei tavshilin.
Shnei tavshilin. Okay. So that makes perfect sense. And then what are we told? In the temple, who's next?
In the temple, they would bring before him the body of the Pesach.
Okay.
So they're tying it to the...
Yeah. Do they do that now? In the time of the Mishnah?
No, they're just connecting it to the...
Yes. At this point in time, just what we have on the table now is the Seder plate. What else would they have on the Seder plate?
The Pesach.
The Pesach. And what's the Pesach mean?
The offering.
The offering. So... the offering would be on the table, and then what would you proceed to?
Eat it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The Seder plate's on the table. Mm-hmm. Are you eating that?
No.
You're going to go through the whole story.
So we're back to our question we asked before about what happens.
So now the telling is in place of the eating of the Pesach.
Okay, so that's very interesting. I want to take a little slightly different route. Okay. Many people, when they read this Mishnah, we said Mishnah 3 is about the ceremonial foods. By the way, does it mention breaking of the matzah?
No.
Okay, so it doesn't. It says bring out the Seder plate and let it sit. And then it says, bring out the Paschal Lamb. And many people who read this Mishnah, including many commentators, traditional commentators, say, you bring it out, but then you turn the page to Mishnah 4, and what do you have to do right now?
Tell the story.
And when will you get to eat? After the story. So then you have to take it. So then a question I like to ask is, the Seder plate includes matzah. There are actually some Seder plates that have layers for them. The typical German Seder plates have that. Okay. So how long can matzah stay on your table before it becomes less appetizing, unappetizing? How long can matzah stay on the table?
It was that way to start.
So matzah, I would say 6 months,
right.
A year. Right. Now, but if you pointed out, if this is the point in time in temple where you brought the Paschal lamb out, where did you bring it from?
The temple?
No, it was brought from the temple in the afternoon.
Oh.
You're bringing it. They bring before him the Paschal lamb. Where are they bringing it from?
From the backyard
where they cooked.
Yes, from the barbecue pit. So, what happens? It gets on the table. How long can it stay?
Not long.
So you are absolutely right. This has to have meant they brought it to the table and they ate it right away. And then you turn to the story. Now let's book back to the Seder plate. What does it say? They brought before him. Now, why doesn't, when it says they brought out the Paschal lamb, why doesn't it say, and they ate it?
Because
That's Mishnah style is terse. Anything you don't have to say, mm-hmm. you don't. Why is it important for Mishnah style to be terse?
So we had to memorize.
Yeah. Right. Habrachmanis, less words. Okay. So the Mishnah, it doesn't say they brought it out and they ate it, because everyone knows when you bring out meat from the barbecue pit, you eat it. You know, you may have heard of the Zaka organization. That's an organization in Israel that after terrorist attacks, they come and their original mission was to collect all the body parts. And then they expanded their mission because they realized they were getting there before the police, and they trained in rescue stuff. So this guy came to America from Zaka, and he says, so his volunteers are all on scooters. And that's why they got to the scene so quickly. And he said he got the idea because he runs a pizza store in Geula. And he says, and he's saying to us, it was the students at Maimonides, he says, and a pizza that isn't hot isn't a pizza. So you have to deliver it right away. So his business model is deliver pizzas
while they're hot.
On a scooter. And that's what he applied to saving lives on a scooter. Okay. So this is the same. The Paschal Lamb, a Paschal Lamb, to paraphrase this man, a Paschal Lamb that isn't hot
isn't worth eating.
Isn't worth eating. And so it's clear that Mishnah 3 was eating time. Now, what about the Passover plate? Read it. They brought before him matzah, chazeret, charoset, and they brought two cooked dishes. Instead of, in temple times, you would have this one fabulous sacrifice. So what did they do? Instead of the sacrifice, they would have two main dishes to make you feel a little better. And when would you eat them, the two cooked dishes?
With the lamb.
No, post-temple times.
After the monkey.
No.
No, right.
They're cooked dishes. A cooked dish.
After your salad.
And so it is quite likely that in the year 200, when the Mishnah was written, the Passover Seder was eat now, talk later. Mm. With the passage of time, this is five generations after the temple. A few generations later, there was a feeling, this isn't working. Why not? Eat now. Two cooked dishes.
Tired after they eat.
Well, why wasn't that a problem in temple times?
Because they didn't have to tell the magi.
Yeah. Or the sacrifice was, oh my God. Or they didn't have to tell the magi. And so at some point in time, relatively early, the magi was switched with the meal. Now, when that switch came about, did they have to change any words in the Mishnah? The most powerful thing when you want to change something, when you have a canonized text, is reinterpretation. And so, because Mishnah 3 never says, and then eat it, you dummy, why didn't it say, and then eat it? It goes without saying, because it didn't say, and then eat it, nothing had to be changed when the custom changed. And so but when it said, bring out the Seder plate with the two cooked dishes, that was reinterpreted. Instead of it being two main dishes, it became two of your symbols on the plate are cooked symbols. The egg and now. Now, that is a remarkable transformation. Now, the great scholar of the Haggadah in the 20th century was a man named Daniel Goldschmidt. Okay? Unfortunately, his Haggadah has never been translated into English. Now, the Shock and Haggadah of he deals with this issue among others. He really reads the Mishnah very closely and learns whatever history he can. Now, the Shock and Haggadah of Nachum Glatzer, the introduction says, based on the work of Daniel Goldschmidt. But what happens when you come to the Maggid? If you open Goldschmidt's Haggadah, it says at the bottom of the page, originally, the meal came before the Maggid. Some of you may have used that Haggadah. It's just a footnote. It's dry as dust. But when you take the text and see how the change grows out of the text, all of a sudden, it's not such a dry footnote. It's about the Haggadah, the Seder as we know it, developed over time. Now, let's go back to the symbolic involvement with food. What's the story? Orchatz, wash your hand, karpas, then what do we do? Yachatz. Say yachatz in English.
Break bread.
Break bread. What does the cliche to break bread mean?
To eat.
Eat. So what was yachatz originally?
Eating.
Eating, the beginning of the meal. And so in every Seder, you have every Seder in the world, every non-Karaite, non-Samaritan Seder, has a breaking of the middle matzah. And that is a reminder of the original Mishnaic Seder in which you ate and then you talked. Okay? Now, when I was in New Haven, I gave a talk about this at the Young Israel of New Haven. Oh, my children have recently said to me, Ab, think, speak, in that order. So, I'll start the story now. But then I'll say, you're right. Think, speak, think, speak. Then I say it to myself, which one was first? Okay. So, there's something else. Yes.
At what point was the egg made into the second cooked dish?
Oh, so that's a. I don't want to talk about that off the top of my head. That okay. would.
That's a big question.
There is some discussion in the Gemara, which is over the next couple of hundred years after the Mishnah.
Okay.
But let's look again at that language about in the temple. They would bring. Uva mikdash hayu mevi'im lefanav shel Pesach. The body of the Paschal Lamb. Sounds
like Jesus.
Catholic.
Yeah.
Okay. That is very interesting. I had taught this Mishnah many times without even noticing anything about this expression. Then I happened to pick up the Blackman Mishnah, which is a British translation, appropriately fussy. And it says, I think it said they would bring before him, I think it says something like the bones. And I'm thinking, why does it say that? That's so odd. And then I'm thinking, maybe they don't want to say in the English translation, the body. Yes, because, and then looking at it further, let's talk about the Catholic connection. The Mishnah is written in the year 200. What does this remind you of? Jesus says in the Last Supper, this is my body. He is a Jew speaking in the idiom of the time. In the idiom of the time, when you spoke of the Paschal Lamb, I took the Paschal, what was the idiom you used in Hebrew? The guf. Okay, perhaps that was a reference to the fact that the Torah says you should roast it whole. So when Jesus says, this is my body, he is using language that's familiar to his listeners. And within several generations later, when the Mishnah is being put in final form, that still is the language that is used. So yet another indication of the linkage between the two traditions. And it's fascinating when we say this, they brought before him the body of the Paschal Lamb, we say, oh, that sounds Christian. Instead of saying...
That sounds Jewish.
Yes. Okay. So... okay, so so I would actually like to call it a day, and it's 9:20, and we have lots of different things we can do tomorrow. So okay, but one of the things that we'll definitely do is what is. Oh, you can keep going. One of the things we'll definitely do is, what is the Magid that's envisioned by the Mishnah? How much of our Magid is in the Mishnah? Okay. Oh, I'll do one more thing with you. I'll do one more tidbit with you. Here's a tidbit. The four questions. We need to look at the Mishnah. What are the four questions of the Mishnah? The next one is
Maror.
Next one is
Pesach.
And the next one is
Dipping.
Okay. So I have here a manuscript, a copy of a manuscript that is from someplace between the year 1000 and 1300. It is the Parma manuscript of the Mishnah. Now, it's available on the web. Okay, anybody can see this complete manuscript. It's located in Parma, Italy, and it has our Mishnah. It's considered to be a very accurate edition of the Mishnah, a manuscript of the Mishnah. And so I'm going to read the questions to you. Okay. Okay. Did I say I was going to read the questions to you?
You did.
Ma nishtana, how are we doing so far?
Good.
Halayla hazeh mikol halelot. Shebechol halelot. Okay. Anu makbilin. Okay. That's... Which question is that? That's
the fourth.
So that question comes first. Why is that?
Because that's the first thing we do.
Yes. And Sephardic Jews, in their Haggadah, one of the few differences between theirs and ours is in the order of the four questions.
Uh-huh.
Next question. Shebechol halelot. Anu ochlin chametz u'matzah. Okay. How are we doing? Good. Next question. Shebechol halelot, we eat meat, overcooked, overbroiled. Remember that one? Anu ochlin basar tzali. Yeah. And then that's it.
Oh.
Yeah. The four questions, this is what's known as voodoo math. If you remember voodoo economics. It's the four questions. Here is an ancient tradition that says that the four questions used to be three. Now, In the Mishnah, there are lots of threes. Three is a nice number. You might have noticed in Mishnah 1, there were three sentences. But there may have been a pulling back from the number three in Jewish symbolism. There may have been. But now, let's see. So if there are three questions, what should be the three questions? One about matzah, mm-hmm. one about
maror,
and one about and one about
Pesach,
matzah, maror, the big three symbols. But what it turns out, there are only three, but it's Pesach, matzah,
and
dipping.
Dipping. Because of the connection to
maror,
the body.
No, because dipping was the maror.
Oh, interesting. The maror and the dipping. We call the dipping question the dipping question in our form. All other nights we don't dip even once. Tonight we dip twice. It's the dipping question. What was the Mishnah's dipping question? All other nights,
we dip once.
Tonight we dip twice. It's not the dipping question. What's special?
Double dipping.
The dip number two, which is
the
maror. Now, let's remember, for whom were these four questions? Who were they composed for?
The children.
The papa.
For the papa, to help the papa deal with the child who cannot ask. So they're the lowest common denominator. So for the maror question, what's the youngest child going to ask? Ooh, we use bitter vegetables tonight? All vegetables are bitter. But it's what the child observes. Oh, there is, the child sees the external. Now, matzah is matzah. Kids can know about that. There's matzah, and the rest of the year there's chametz. Now, what about the question about the Paschal lamb? It could have been, boy, all other nights we eat stuff from Reuben's, MSG galore. But tonight we're eating stuff from the altar that was from the temple that's sacred. Is that what this question is? The sacrifice, does it mention the word sacrifice? What can a kid notice?
How it's prepared.
A kid cannot say, oh, wow, you know, this was sacrificed according to all the laws of Leviticus. How unusual. No, the kid says, oh, there seems to have been a big deal that this had to be barbecued. So what we learn from that manuscript is the earlier four questions, which were three, and really focusing in on the extent to which the questions were child's eye questions about the externals that the younger child can absorb. Can we now imagine why a fourth question arose? Before we speculated, perhaps there was an uneasiness with the number three. Can we take it in a different direction? Matzah, the Paschal lamb, and for maror, how did we ask about maror? By the dipping. But when the dipping question changed, it no longer felt like a maror question. So someone came up with
a maror
question. And from then on, you had four questions. Now let's examine this maror question. All other nights we eat chametz and matzah. Tonight we eat only, all other nights we eat A and B. Tonight we eat only matzah. And the maror question, all other nights we eat all vegetables, and tonight we eat
bitter vegetables.
It's not true. We eat maror, and so this new question It's not such a great question. Someone really wanted a question that had in it the word maror. But it's not up to the quality control standards of the original questions.
We need the College Board here.
Okay. Is that heretical?
No, I guess I'm not troubled by it in the same way.
Okay.
In that, I guess I have always read the question as saying we can eat whatever vegetables and probably would normally not go out of our way to have maror because we can eat whatever. Tonight we make a specific point of having maror, not necessarily to the exclusion of others, but to the
That's
inclusion
okay,
of maror.
But you've just added a lot of words to this little question. And for the other questions, you didn't have to add all those words. Right? Okay. So are you disagreeing with me? Are you saying there's not a difference in tone in that question with respect to that question as opposed to the other question? I'm okay with that. Yeah?
I have a question about the four.
Yeah.
So you start out and the four cups are prescribed. That's like central. So you set up that number as being, and wine is like blood and...
No.
Wine is not like blood.
Right.
Okay. All right. So
only
Shapiro's
wine is like blood.
So I don't know. I think it's interesting
this
that they were trying to get rid of the number three.
We don't know that.
Possibly, but there's that symmetry of four.
Okay. So what you're saying is, once you have four cups, it's a nice touch to have four questions.
And four sons.
Right. Four sons. Yeah. Now. Does the Mishnah go with the notion of four sons? How many sons does the Mishnah contemplate?
Two
kinds of sons. Yes,
but
you are right.
Could be multiple because he talks about according to the understanding.
Yes.
So you could add.
Right. Yes. Very good. Now, no question that. When the three questions moves along and becomes four questions, then the number four works out very nicely. Now, look at the very first Mishnah of the chapter. The first time we're introduced to four cups. How are we introduced to four cups?
That you're going to give it to the poor person. And he's going to go to
that. How are we introduced to the number four?
Well, it says not less than four.
Yeah. So was this Mishnah articulated at a point in time when it wasn't specifically four, and that itself may have been a later development?
As long as it's not three.
If you like. Okay. All right. We're going to call it a day.
A day.
A day. A day.